Sometimes it seems, doesn't it, as if God isn't there. Times can get challenging. Things can happen that you would have wished hadn't happened. You just got to live with it sometimes when you really feel the felt presence of the Lord of Glory might have been a significant help to you. But the heavens are like brass. Deuteronomy 28:23 describes the effect of the withdrawal of God's covenant blessings as feeling like that, as if the heavens are hardened over as hard as brass. This was their Bronze Age. And of course, brass, they sort of got the idea about bronze and brass and that sort of thing being hard stuff. Esther is a book for that sort of circumstance, when God seems far off and your circumstances are perplexing. It's a book that never mentions God. Prayer doesn't happen. God's voice is not heard. Yet where God's very imperfect people don't hold back but step out in faith, and when they do that, well, there are just so many apparent coincidences and reversals of bad situations taking place. For anybody to come to the conclusion that God is as absent as he feels, he's not absent, he's there all the time. He's inviting faith. He's just not making much noise. Now, of course, here in Esther, the people of God are in exile, and here's the thing. They've been put there for good reason. They persistently turned their back on their God and were now living with all the sorts of foretold consequences of violating God's covenant that they were warned of back in Deuteronomy 28. They were in a bad situation. But the faithful God had not given up on them, and here's how that becomes apparent in the book of Esther. I just want to say the deep structure of this book is even more beautifully crafted than even like something like the book of Ruth we looked at a while ago. And that's absolutely exquisite, is Ruth. But here I'm very briefly outlining the contents of Esther just today to give an overview and make a fairly important point for us. Hopefully then in the coming weeks we'll go and look at Esther a bit more and we'll gain a better grasp and understanding on how that is a book that could really help us in our times. Story of Esther set over 100 years, probably 150 years, after God's people were exiled to Babylon. And while some Jews had returned to Jerusalem, you think of Ezra and Nehemiah and their returns, many did not return. So the book of Esther is about a Jewish community living in Susa, which was the capital city of the ancient Persian Empire. It's disputed, but it certainly looks like that. They hadn't returned to Jerusalem, these people, and they were still living in exile under very adverse circumstances. And there are two main characters in the story, two Jewish people, Mordecai and his niece Esther. And then, of course, you've got the king of Persia, who's a bit of a drunken pushover of a man in this story. And then there's the government official, Haman, who's a bit of a cunning pantomime villain and a nasty one at that. Remember, the big thing is that God is always at work in this story, but always behind the scenes. And there is the point. Now, the first section of the book revolves around Esther and the king. Esther and the king are in the harlot in chapters 1 to 3, their story. First of all, you get this banquet that's put on by the king of Persia in chapters 1 and 2. And the king of Persia throws a pair of very elaborate feasts that last 187 days. And he does it all to display his greatness and his splendour. And on the final day, in an alcoholic haze, he demands his wife, Queen Vashti, comes into the feast and displays herself for the men to gawp at and admire her good looks, all to further enhance his own ego. And she says no. Just refuses, which you don't do for a bloke like that. And in his drunken rage, he deposed Vashti and issued a decree that all Persian men should now be the masters of their own home. What a guy. And then the king sets up a beauty contest to find his new queen. And this is where we meet Esther and Mordecai. You see, Esther should have been a good Jewish girl, but she enters this contest, not revealing she's Jewish, and she wins. The king is obsessed with her and makes this Jewish woman his queen. And then an even bigger coincidence is that Mordecai then happens to overhear two royal guards plotting to murder the king of Persia. And Mordecai tells Esther, and Esther tells the king, and Mordecai gets credited with saving the king's life, which becomes important later on. No mention of God, but this all has the hallmarks of God's providence. And you're left thinking, hang on, so much of this looks bad and wrong. What is it that God is up to here? But it's all going well. All heading in a positive sort of direction until up pops Haman. You get Haman the Agagite in chapter 3. Now, Haman, we're told, was an Agagite, and the Agagites were ancient Canaanite people. You can read about them in 1 Samuel 15. Haman the Agagite gets promoted to the most eminent position in the kingdom, and the decree is issued that everybody should kneel before Haman. And Mordecai, maybe, we're not told, but maybe it's his Jewish background that you worship God alone. Mordecai refuses, and Haman ain't happy. And when he discovers Mordecai is Jewish, he gets the king to make a crazy decree to destroy all the Jewish people. Now, here's a quirky thing. To discover the auspicious time that they should approach the king to ask for this act of genocide, Haman and his guys, they roll dice called Pur in Hebrew, or Purim if there's two of them. Hold on to that little nugget of a thought, because we're going to come back to it. Purim, the dice. Once the king and Haman have agreed on this genocide, they indulge in a big drinking session together. And that takes us to the second section of the story. In the second section of the story, Haman sets out to conflict with God's people. That's chapters 4 to 5. See, Esther and Mordecai form a plan in chapter 4. Now, please notice this is not a plan to wait on their God, who hasn't been even mentioned in the account so far and certainly hasn't said anything to them at all. There have been interesting providences along the route, but no clear stepping in of God into the story. So what do Mordecai and Esther do in this awful situation? They don't sit back and wait for the Lord, but they act to protect the Lord's cause in his people. Esther, it is planned, is going to go to the king. Tell him she's Jewish and ask him to reverse the decree against her people. Now that is extremely courageous. Because approaching the king without an invitation in that place and in that time was an act that would carry the death penalty. That's the kind of guy Esther was dealing with. If you spoke to him when you weren't spoken to, he'd kill you. But it was Esther's initiative to do this, her plan, and she sent the message to Mordecai to tell him about it. And in a context where God seems to be silent in the face of his people's sufferings, there's something telling about the message that Mordecai sends back. He says, this is Esther 4 verse 15, "If you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place." Got that? Relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. "But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this." Such a time as this. Come to the kingdom for such a time as this. When have you gone through that sort of hampering, obstructing frustration and through the sort of what next now, Lord, experience that, you know, many can say we've had for the last few years through a group after COVID and stuff. There's something inspiring in that message of Mordecai's. But even more inspiring is Esther's response back to Mordecai. She says, "Go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I'll go to the king, and though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. I will go to the king, though it's against the law, and if I perish, I perish." Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. That's Esther 4, 16 and 17. Interestingly there, Esther has undergone a huge change of status in the story at this point, as she's resolved on this act of great faith and risk, and Mordecai goes away, and it says, and did everything as Esther had ordered him. That's a clear reversal of their roles. The woman is now in charge. So now we find Esther throwing a banquet to press forward the plan that in courageous faith Esther and Mordecai have settled upon. Esther has a banquet. She throws a banquet then. Chapter 5. Banquets everywhere in this book. Esther invites Haman and the king to an amazing banquet that she's hosting the next day. And Haman leaves drunk and immediately sees Mordecai in the street. And he fumes at Mordecai, who won't kneel to him, and orders that a tall stake be set up in the ground so that Mordecai can be impaled on it in the morning. They're going to shove him on the spike. It's beginning to look as if things can't get any worse for God's people. They'd gone on quietly for maybe 150 years, living under adverse circumstances with a terrible king afflicting them. But everything's starting to look pretty serious now. Well, in chapter 6 to 8, Esther and Mordecai, nonetheless, take their initiative. The pivotal point is in chapter 6. In chapter 6, the king's struggling to sleep, so he has someone come and read to him from the annals of his reign. And that person just happens to read the bit about the time when Mordecai had saved the king's life. The king had totally forgotten about that. So come the morning, Haman came in to request Mordecai should be impaled on the stake, but before he could get to it, the king asked, "What should be done to the man whom the king delights to honour?" And Haman said to himself, whom would the king delight to honour more than me? And Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king delights to honour, let royal robes be brought which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honour. Let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honour. Then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you've said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave nothing out that you have mentioned. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honour. Well, Haman's had a total reversal there, hasn't he, of his fortunes. Haman rushed home to his wife and family in despair, and they responded, if Mordecai, before whom you've begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. That's Esther 6:13. Excuse me. Now those words mark the pivot in the book, and here's where Haman's downfall and the preservation of God's people begins. Esther has a second banquet in chapters 7 and 8. It kind of balances the one she just threw just before. And, you know, this is where things really begin. The tide begins to turn, and there's no mention of God still. And there's no mention of prayer, and there's no mention of... It's odd, but you can't help thinking all the time, there's a God behind this. Look, it's ironic, this reversal. There's an intelligence. It's God is at work. So when the king and Haman arrive then, chapters 7 and 8, Esther tells the king she's Jewish, and that Haman has manoeuvred the king into enacting a decree to murder Mordecai, who'd saved the king's life, along with all of the other Jews. The king's already had quite a lot to drink by then, so when he hears this, he flies off into yet another drunken rage, and he goes out into the garden to plan what he's going to do about it. The king got up in rage, left his wine, and went out into the palace garden. But Haman, realising the king had already decided his fate, stayed behind to beg Queen Esther for his life. And then, just as the king returned from the palace garden to the banqueting hall, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was reclining. He's begging her, you see. The king came in and got the wrong idea. The king exclaimed, will he even molest the queen while she is with me in the house? And as soon as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs attending the king, said, a pole reaching to a height of 50 cubits stands by Haman's house. He set it up for Mordecai, who spoke up to help the king. And the king said, impale him on it. So they impaled Haman on the pole he'd set up for Mordecai. And then the king's fury subsided. You can read about that in Esther 7, 7-10. The king ordered Haman be impaled on the very stake he'd set up for Mordecai. It's ironic. God, the God who's not getting mentioned, has behind the scenes reversed the situation for his people. But the snag is this. The snag is that the king has already issued this decree. He's already made it to kill the Jewish people. And he can't revoke a decree he's already made. It's a long-standing fundamental principle of Persian law. So the king has decreed death to all the Jewish people because of Haman. And the king commissions Mordecai to issue a counter decree that the Jewish people must resist and destroy anyone who plots or sets out to kill them on the day appointed for the slaughter of the Jews. So they've got round it. They've made a suggestion and they've got round it. And there can now be great celebration. And there is great celebration. And Mordecai is elevated to sit beside the king. Well, okay, chapters 9 to 10 are all about the deliverance and the commemoration of it, of the Jewish people. Firstly, the Jews are mandated to wipe out Haman's gang, and then on a second day, they get mandated to deal with anyone who threatens them throughout the kingdom. They're protected. It's all turned around. The whole situation has been transformed. And then Esther and Mordecai establish by decree this annual two-day feast of Purim to commemorate their deliverance from destruction. Do you remember that word, Purim? The name of the feast comes from Haman's dice, his Purim. Haman was trying to figure out destiny with those dice. But God is the one who controls destiny. And through a heady mix of irony and reversals, Esther shows us that the God who doesn't shout always works out his destiny according to his plan by his inscrutable providence. So here's the conclusion. Now look, this book is structured really cleverly. I've not gone into the detail of that now. Maybe we'll do that again. Structured really cleverly with things the baddies have going their way to determine to the detriment of God's people. In the first part of the book, being mirrored by they're going God's way in the second part for the benefit of his people. It's a detailed structure. I'll be getting it into it in our DIY Sunday service kit online over the next few weeks. But here and now, I'm just highlighting that the disasters coming across the path of God's people that seemed likely to have them annihilated, they get wound back. You don't see God downstage front center of the story. Not even prayed to. Not even mentioned. But Esther and Mordecai go out on a limb. They put their lives on the line. They take initiative almost in the dark with no clear word from God to light their way. They just know the kind of thing that God would want to happen. And God's providence is clearly at work in the ironic reversals that scatter the path as they act. There's just one more astonishing thing to point out here. It's not just that people do what they know God would want without writing in the sky when the heavens is quite quiet. There's this other astonishing thing. God is faithful to his very imperfect people. In general, the people were exiled, as Deuteronomy 28 points out they would be, because they'd wandered badly and persistently from God. By the time of the exile, by the time of the events of Esther, they'd been in exile for 150 years or so. And while some had returned to the land that God had appointed to them, the ones that we're hearing of here clearly hadn't gone back. There's that. But over and above and beyond that, there's the moral ambiguity and moral failure going on in this story. You see, Esther was a Jewish girl, but she married a Gentile. And the guy she married was not an honourable man. He was not a good Sunday school boy. And there's a lot of drinking and sex and murder going on in the book, and there are clear violations of the Torah and its commands. Esther and Mordecai are not put forward as an example of great moral behaviour, but of trust and hope when things are threatening and look like turning out badly. They do trust God and act along the lines that they knew he'd want them to. So why is God not mentioned? The message of the book seems to be that despite exile, God's apparent absence in their experience and Israel's moral compromise, even then, God's not abandoned his promises or his faithfulness to his people. His faithful but very unworthy people. God in this book can do and does work in the mess and even in the moral ambiguity of human history, which is not to excuse it, but it's to glorify the God of such grace. Life after Genesis 3, the fall, certainly really very, very messy. But here, even in this book, God uses the faithfulness of even sinners to accomplish his purposes. That isn't to say he accommodates sin and bends and bows to it. It is to say that he has got grace to offer to people willing to trust God's providence, even when we can't see it working. And so far, we've learned from the book of Esther that God is committed to redeeming in his world. He's committed to even redeeming rural Wales. And we need to trust him to work that out, even while it feels as if God, where is he? You can't feel his presence there. Very often. No writing on the sky. Do you know, in reality, there are many times in the unfolding story of God's people when it seems as if God is absent. Exile. Things working against God's people. Times when it seems God is nowhere to be found. Lord, what is happening here? Where are you? And right at those times when you think God is most absent, those are the times when God is most present. Very often. Working in strange and mysterious, sometimes ironic ways behind the scenes, showing his character, showing humour. The way these reversals work out, they're quite ironic. The book of Esther is trying to challenge and inspire us to trust God through challenging times, even times when it most seems that God is absent and you can't see that he's at work, and then he is. Surprisingly, there it is. What we need at such times is to seek God's Spirit to work on us with this book that he has inspired, to challenge our worldview, and for us to discover again how God is at work in our story, even when we at the moment are not feeling him there. To do that here in rural Wales and across the world that he sends us to serve him in is where the challenge of faith often arises for the people of God. And when you're in those times when bad things seem to be happening and God seems far away, these God-inspired coincidences, in inverted commas, still happen. It's because God is still quietly at work, driving forward his gracious plans and his heavenly purposes. And our part is to go on taking the initiatives and pushing at the doors in front of us, in the spirit of Esther, and if I perish, I perish. Because he's quiet. God is quiet. But that does not mean that he's not still powerfully at work. He is. And that's why we keep on looking for the ways that we're certain he'd want us to behave. Taking the initiatives that we're certain and sure that he'd want us to take. And that's why we carry on trying to walk forward in faith for him into securing the priorities and objectives that are on the heart of our God. God does seem absent. Take heart. He isn't. He's powerfully at work. God bless you. Have a great week.